Homage to the Buddha, homage to the Dharma, homage to the Sangha. My voice is a little weak, having just sung vigorously for an hour, but I think I can still use it for this purpose. Well, today I'd like to talk further about the conversion of a hungry ghost. Those of you who are here for the retreat, of course, have been hearing about that in various ways and contexts during the retreat. And there are a few additional things I'd like to bring out today. Those of you who are new to our monastery may not have heard of this ceremony before. I'll explain a little bit about it. And just very briefly, it's called the Feeding of the Hungry Ghost Ceremony, and it's a ceremony in which we do our very best to offer comfort, love, solace, the food of the Dharma in various forms to all people who have died, in particular those whose names we've placed on a list, relatives, friends, loved ones, who we're remembering today. And especially this ceremony is for those who may have died in very tragic circumstances, very unhappy deaths, very distressed, suicides, and so on. They particularly need help. Very intense states of clinging, for example, people who might have died in that state. And so it's interesting in reading a little bit about the ceremony. The origins of it go to the time of the Buddha, when one of his disciples, in fact, one of his chief disciples, Moggallana, who became one of his became an arahant, who was enlightened, found that his had a vision of his mother after she died, very thin and desiccated, and in a state of extreme suffering, hanging upside down. And apparently, that the term ulambana means hung upside down, a terrible state of suffering, both physically and spiritually. And he saw his mother in this unhappy state, unable to receive any comfort or take in any food. She was yearning for food and water, and even though he offered some to her, she couldn't partake of it. And at the moment that she was about to consume the food or water, it would turn to fire. So ulambana is the name of this particular form of suffering, in fact, became the name of the ceremony that they held at the end of the rains retreat at the time of the Buddha. Well, the Buddha, Moggallana, very distressed, ran to the Buddha and said, "Gosh, what can I do for her? She can't, I can't help her in any way." And the Buddha quietly answered that, well, since she'd had no one to take care of her before her, after her death, the clinging that she already experienced became very extreme. And Moggallana felt deep contrition for his selfishness, it said, and before he became the Buddha's disciple, of course, and for his egocentricity, apparently, and that he was aware that he'd really taken care of no one but himself. And so he asked the Buddha for help, a way of rescuing her, and the Buddha advised him to summon all the monks nearby and hold a memorial service for her by offering food, clothing, and other necessities to the monks, and the whole congregation, in fact. And in fact, the Buddha suggested, and they do this still in the Far East, that the best time for this was in the middle of July, when in some of the eastern countries, the rainy season ends, and the monks would have been in retreat for 3 months, and would have been need not only in need of food and so on, but also would have been able to offer the fruits of their retreat for these beings. And so this was how this ceremony started. In Japan, where our tradition comes from, the ulambana was eventually transliterated, into the term oban, uraban, oban now. And so they celebrate it also in the summer. And it's a memorial service, a big memorial for, again, relatives and so on. Priests go to people's houses and offer merit and food and and incense at the private altars. And in fact, people in Japan apparently go to the graveyards and invite their relatives to come to the temples. They have a four-day celebration, and at the end, they have, of course, a big feast, and they send their loved ones off on little boats. They have these boats with lanterns that they send out on the water to help them to cross over to the other shore where they can be free of suffering. Well, there's another service called the Sagaki service, and it seems that the one that we do is sort of a combination of the Uraban and the Sagaki service, although I'm not certain of this, but it certainly looks like it. And the Sagaki literally means offering to those in desperate need. And so I guess in Japan, it's a bit of a ceremony in which people offer generosity to those in need, both dead and alive. And therefore, we particularly honor the ones who've died, who are in desperate need during our ceremony. The interesting origin of that particular ceremony dates back to, or is described in the Mahaparinirvana Sutra, where Ananda, one of the Buddha's disciples, apparently was very ill and was in great agony, and a demon appeared and predicted that he would die in a few days. And astonished at this, Ananda asked him if there was any way to escape his fate. And the demon replied that he would be safe if he offered food and propounded the noble teaching. So here we have this tradition of offering food and the Dharma for those in desperate need. So according to the sutra, he did so and was saved. And as the author here says, this teaches the importance of giving to others who are in desperate need. The Japanese see this as a kind of Thanksgiving ceremony, interestingly enough. So perhaps this is a nice way for us to lead into Thanksgiving ourselves next month. So it's a memorial. It's an expression of great generosity, of grasping our own wills, raising our own seed of Dharma, and offering that to beings in need, including ourselves, because ultimately there's no separation between ourselves and those who have died in one sense. We open the gate of the Dharma. Now, what is a hungry ghost? You've heard something about that this weekend, those of you who have been here for the retreat. The hungry ghost is a state, a hungry ghost realm, if you like, is a state of existence or a state of rebirth, one of six worlds that beings can be born into, or six states of existence, primary ones that we can experience. Even as human beings, we might have some experience of some of these other realms, or at least some aspects of them. Again, this teaching goes to the time of the Buddha, when he talks about karma and his disciples. So much of the Buddha's teaching, of course, comes from his disciples asking him questions. So we're always grateful when people ask questions, because without them, perhaps we wouldn't have nearly as much teaching and Dharma available. While the Buddha's talking about how karma is created, he said that it's choice. This is in the Anguttara Nikaya, the Book of Gradual Sayings. He's quoted to have said, "It is choice or volition or intention that I call action. It is in choosing that a person acts by body, speech, and mind. There are actions whose ripening will be experienced in hell, in the animal womb, in the realm of ghosts, among human beings, and in heavenly worlds." Of course, we also know that there's a sixth one, the world of the fighting spirits or angry spirits, the Titan Asura, as we call them. So he says, actions ripen in three ways. They can ripen here and now, so we experience these states in our present lives, on reappearance, or in some life process beyond that. And it seems that, of course, this kind of ripening has particular consequences in this life, through our feeling. We experience it through thought. In other existences, it can take the form of ghostly appearances, ghostly forms. And of course, it's not important to necessarily believe in these things. That's not the point of the teaching. But just to have an open mind and to know that the things that we don't deal with completely in this life, the clinging that we suffer from, if it becomes intense and we do not make an effort to do something about it, can continue, according to Buddhist teaching, in the next life and in other lives. And it can end up in very, very woeful states of very extreme suffering. It's said that the best ideal world to train in, to be successful in realizing our enlightenment, is that of the human world. But even as humans, upon reflection, I've certainly felt that we sometimes forget that we're human and lean towards the animal realms, perhaps, or the fighting spirit realms, when we think that the best way to solve conflict is to, go to war and so on. So it's good to reflect on how even as humans we might neglect our own humanity and the precious gift that we've been given as humans to realize the truth in this lifetime. Interestingly, these worlds are all temporary, according to Buddhist teaching. In Buddhism, no one is ever damned to any particular world. It's not like that. They are simply the consequences of our own thoughts and actions. And by doing something about ourselves, by training ourselves, we can also be freed from these states. So they are temporary. Even the most pleasant of these worlds, the heavens, are also temporary, which is very interesting. They might be extremely pleasant. One might be in them for a long time, but one's time will eventually be up in that heaven as well. So there's always the need for training, whether one finds oneself in a hell or in a heaven, and sometimes even more so in a heavenly state, I think, because we forget about the fact that there is suffering and that distress and so on can lead us to creating more suffering. In many of you may have seen the Tibetan Wheel of Life, a teaching that comes out of course, these teachings from the Buddha, depicting the six worlds, and in which one sees each of the worlds in a circle. In the center of the circle, in the center of the wheel, in the center of all of these various worlds, is an empty place. And interestingly, around that is a pig representing greed, poor pigs, and a snake representing anger or hate, and also a rooster representing delusion and cockiness. Interesting, they use that sort of image for delusion or confusion. And these beings, these animals, are all sort of chasing each other's tails in a circle, which represents sort of the source of the suffering, the ignorance of the emptiness of the Buddha nature at the heart of our existence, at the heart of our lives. And if we don't know how to sit still in that empty place, within that stillness, at the center of the wheel, then we, through one of the means of either greed, anger, or delusion, sort of get thrown into these various worlds. And that's how I would experience it in terms of my own training. Certainly when I first came to training, my emotions were all over the place. And we still have emotions after training, but nonetheless we have some sense that they're not everything there is. They're not so important. They are not necessarily fundamental to who I am. I don't have to chase after them, but I also don't have to try to get rid of them. They're just there. They're results of actions, thoughts, and so on from the past, part of being human. So when we don't know how to meditate, we tend to have that sense of being driven somewhat, or being just sort of falling from one thing to another without purpose. And it's extremely painful, of course, as we all know. Even the slightest trickle of dharma of teaching, even just a second of meditation can help take us out of that. And so that's why we do these kinds of ceremonies for beings who are really caught in these situations. Just as we help ourselves in this way, we can also be a great benefit to others who are, in one sense, quite dependent on our help. And so it's a great, the ceremony is a great expression of the Bodhisattva vow, really, to help all beings in all places, to transform our passions, to completely penetrate the Dharma without hindrance, and to offer that to all beings and save them wherever we can. Just to illustrate a little bit more about what this kind of thing, what we're talking about with regards to hungry ghost karma, I'm going to read a little bit to you from a book that some of you might be familiar with called Return from Tomorrow. I'm interested in this because it's written by a Christian, and so he wouldn't have had any Buddhist context, you know, for what he sees. If you haven't heard of the book, it's written by a man called George Ritchie, who had a near-death experience when he was 20 years old in December 1943 while in basic training at Camp Barkley in Texas. He died of double lobar pneumonia. And 9 minutes later, he miraculously and unaccountably returned to life. So it's rather one of the longer near-death experiences. And of course, he lived to tell what he experienced and saw during that time. And he wasn't a particularly religious young man either, which is very interesting. But as he becomes aware that that body in that bed there is that he's seeing is himself, he begins to get pretty into a panic and looks for help. And fortunately, he has somewhere along the line enough faith to trust that there's something greater than this life and that his small self. So he begins to experience this light near him that's guiding him, which eventually he sees as Jesus, of course, coming from a Christian background. He's guided through parts of his life to help him see, you know, what the purpose of his life was, how, you know, times when he was selfish, times when he wasn't selfish. He begins to be shown the karmic consequences of everything he did in his life. And then eventually he's taken on a bit of a journey. And some of the journey and the things that he sees are just amazingly Buddhist descriptions of some of the six worlds. So I'll just read you a little bit from this. It's very interesting. He's being taken to a city somewhere on the East Coast. And this is in a disembodied state. He says, I noticed this phenomena repeatedly. People unaware of others right beside them. He's talking about being in a crowded city and these ghostly beings kind of talking to others and trying to convince them of things and nothing's happening. They can't be heard. He says, I saw a group of assembly line workers gathered around a coffee canteen in a building. One of the women asked another for a cigarette, begged her, in fact, as though she wanted it more than anything in the world. But the other one, chatting with her friends, ignored her. She took a pack of cigarettes from her coveralls and, without ever offering it to the woman who reached for it so eagerly, took one out and lit it. Fast as a striking snake, the woman who had been refused snatched at the lighted cigarette in the other one's mouth. Again she grabbed at it, and again and again. With a little chill of recognition, I saw that she was unable to grip it. So this is an example, very good example, of just a kind of clinging, a simple thing, like an addiction to cigarettes, that, you know, can potentially carry on into beyond death. And just the sadness of that clinging, sort of repeating itself and repeating itself. Here's another one. It was so very different from the way I had always imagined death. I watched one woman of maybe 50 following a man of about the same age down the street. She seemed very much alive, agitated, and tearful, except that the man to whom she was addressing her emphatic words was oblivious to her existence. "You're not getting enough sleep. Marjorie makes too many demands on you. You know you've never been strong. Why aren't you wearing a scarf? You should never have married a woman who thinks only of herself," and so on. There was more, and from some of it I gathered that she was his mother, in spite of the fact that they appeared so nearly the same age. How long had she been following him this way? Was this what death was like, to be permanently invisible to the living, yet permanently wrapped up in their affairs, the old affairs? So that's an interesting example. And then, of course, every so often throughout his the things that he sees and his experiences, he calls up his lessons from Sunday school and anything that he heard along the lines of religion that clearly helped to explain to him what to do in the midst of these situations. So he quotes here from Jesus' Sermon on the Mount, lay not up for yourselves treasures on earth, for where your treasure is, there will your heart be also. He says, "I'd never been any good at memorizing scripture, but those words of Jesus from the Sermon on the Mount sprang into my mind now like an electric shock. Perhaps these insubstantial people, the businessman, the woman begging cigarettes, this mother, although they could no longer contact the earth, still had their hearts there. Did I?" With a kind of terror, this is a 20-year-old guy, right? With a kind of terror, I thought of that Eagle Scout badge that I was so proud of, or being a Phi Gam, or getting into med school. Was my heart, the focus of my being, fixed on things like these? So, quite innocent things, but he's beginning to realize, wow, where has my heart been? Has this been the entire focus of my life? I think this is a nice, a good example of the kind of things that we don't have to understand them, we don't even have to believe in them, but the kind of things that we can help by holding out our faith and by doing our training as best we can, and why these ceremonies have survived, in this case, 2,500 years. Lastly, I'll just give you some examples of why, another reason why we do the ceremony. In one house, he says, traveling along, a younger man followed an older one from room to room. "I'm sorry, Pa," he kept saying. "I didn't know what it would do to Mama. I didn't understand." And so he goes on. But though I could hear him clearly, it was obvious that the man he was speaking to could not. The old man was carrying a tray into a room where an elderly woman sat in bed. "I'm sorry, Pa," the young man said again. "I'm sorry, Mama," endlessly, over and over, to ears that could not hear. In bafflement, this is the author, I turned to the brightness beside me. But though I felt his compassion flow like a torrent into the room before us, no understanding lighted my mind. Several times we paused before similar scenes. A boy trailing a teenage girl through the corridors of a school. "I'm sorry, Nancy." A middle-aged woman begging a gray-haired man to forgive her. What are they sorry for? He is pleading to find out. Why do they keep talking to people who can't hear them? And then from the light beside me came the thought, they're suicides, chained to every consequence of their act. So, very sad, but it does give a very clear picture, a graphic picture of the kind of suffering that exists. And of course, again, remember these things are not separate from ourselves. We have these kinds of things going through our own minds. When we meditate, we begin to see the patterns of suffering that we've created, and we have certain themes, don't we, of feeling regret, or of still clinging to things that we don't even necessarily want, but just habitual clingings. And of course, as we meditate, they arise, we begin to see them, and begin to be able to cut the clinging to them, cut the the pattern, if it were, as it were, and free ourselves from that. So it's no different, in the sense, what we're doing during the ceremony from what we would do in our own meditation. It's very, very important to understand that, because it's not some abstract, magical thing that we're doing. Well, I wanted to, along those lines, describe a bit about this wonderful picture we have up here on the altar. This is a picture of a hungry ghost being converted. And I know we got the picture, wherever Master used to refer it to, we used to talk about it as the Gaki who got religion. Gaki is the Japanese term for a hungry ghost, or one in desperate need, as we discovered. And in this case, perhaps you can go up to the picture later and see it in a little closer. There's a lot of wonderful detail in there. You'll see over on the left side of the picture an altar with some monks doing a ceremony. And the celebrant is wearing a bodhisattva crown. Probably it's in the Chinese tradition. And his two chaplains there, and they're doing very much along the lines of what Reverend Master Mayan was doing at the ceremony today. They're offering scriptures, they're chanting, and one of the beautiful things about it is that the expressions on their faces are so peaceful and downright joyous. You can see the great joy that they're experiencing in making this opportunity available. So essentially, they're doing a sagaki ceremony, offering the Dharma through music, through sound, through scriptures, through their meditation, their presence, and also through food. You know, food in many cultures is a symbol of love, isn't it? And it is a way of offering love. So we use that as a way of offering love and merit and Dharma. One might not be able to hear the words, but one definitely will be attracted to food, whoever one is. In front of the monks, in the middle, is another altar with three towers of food offerings. Usually there's one of dried food and wet food. In the middle are these steam buns that would be a typical Chinese food and treat for a festival. Today, our cook has made a peanut butter chocolate chip cookies, which we would think is a somewhat typical, much-loved American treat. So it should be something that is appealing to beings in the culture. But just in case we have, gakis coming from other directions, we have provided a great variety of foods, including foods from the sea, such as sea vegetables, foods from the land, food from trees, from bushes, all sorts of places, as much variety as possible so that as many ghosts as possible can find nourishment. So you'll see in front of the food altar there are some ghosts, if you like, some gakis sitting on the altar already, excuse me, eating buns, handing them down to the others. In the higher reaches of the picture, you see some of the beings coming out of the hells and out of the various ghostly realms in states of confusion. And as they come down, they're drawn to the feast, as it were, and they begin to see what's happening and come and partake of the offering. And so it's worth looking at the picture closely because there's some really great characters in there. Some of them are sitting down eating. Some are filling up their bags and taking them away for others. There's one up there that's got a very extended belly. It's said, you know, in some depictions of hungry ghosts, they have great large bellies in the way that one might if one were starving, very narrow throats, and so consequently very hard to take in food even when it's offered. And there's one up there who's getting his belly massaged, so I'm not sure if he's softening him up to be able to receive food or whether he's got a tummy ache from eating too much. But anyway, there's a great deal of wonderful humor worked into these things. You'll see banners of the Buddhas floating. There may be scriptures on the banners. Some are taking away the Dharma in the form of the banners. Some are taking away food. And it also gives, interestingly enough, an opportunity to the gakis to be generous as well to others. In the center of the picture is a hungry ghost in the process of conversion. And he has accepted the food of the Dharma. He's holding one of the buns. He's taking it in. He's meditating. He's accepting the Dharma. Normally when a hungry ghost tries to take in food, of course, as we said, it would turn to fire and it seems impossible to eat. In this case, he's sitting very still with that impossibility, if you like. He's willing to sit still in the midst of his condition, the condition that he is currently suffering from, the intense craving, becoming immovable and completely accepting of the karma that he's created. You can see his belly is on fire, his throat is on fire, his hair is in flames. He's a pretty wild-looking guy. And yet he sits in trust and faith, and he's beginning to turn the stream of compassion within. And that's what conversion is in the Buddhist sense, is turning the stream of compassion within, or it begins with that. He's no longer running away from it. He's no longer looking outside of himself for that comfort. He's willing to accept the help of the Dharma. You can also see at the top the cooling of his passions, of his craving occurring. There's these great streams of water coming out from behind his head, the water of the spirit rising up his spine. His eyes are wide open. His heart is willing, and he's getting religion. He's getting the fact that there is no need to cling to anything, actually, and that there is comfort, there is peace and solace, there is truth, and that in fact he can find it within himself, and indeed he is, and that he no longer needs to wander the nether worlds driven by these longings, these yearnings, to seek satisfaction in external things, whether they be material things or even desires for enlightenment, thinking that one might find that somewhere else other than where one is. He's beginning to see the ways that he's lived that lead to the creation of suffering. And his pain dissolves into the immaculacy of emptiness, of Buddha nature. In Buddhism, this is what, again, conversion is seeing the non-self, seeing the emptiness of the things that we have been clinging to, the clinging itself, seeing our true nature. At the top of the picture, you see an image of Kanzion, Bodhisattva of compassion, rising up from his crown. So having turned the stream of compassion within himself, not only is the compassion healing him, it also makes it available to all the others. And he becomes as a Buddha on the altar and an example to all the other gakis. So he is, in fact, a Buddha. Here you see Kanzeon sprinkling with the willow twig the healing waters of compassion for the benefit of all. So just as in Buddhism we do have this practice of putting beings on the altar when there is a conversion taking place, whether it be at a memorial ceremony, a funeral, we put the ashes or the body or a memorial tablet representing that person. As many of you know, during the keeping of the 10 precepts retreat, those who have just taken the precepts mount the altar as baby Buddhas. And so just reminding us, just to be very clear on the fact that that Buddhahood is possible for us. The priests are holding out their faith and offering all that they can to encourage the gakis and to enter the gate of the Dharma, to be free of their suffering. So I strongly recommend having a close look at it. It's a great image, and it's one actually by, just as an aside, that when I, years ago, was one of the priors at Throssell Hole Buddhist Priory at that time. It wasn't an abbey yet. A number of American monks and Canadian monks were sent over there while the British monks were training here with Reverend Master Jiu. And as one of my responsibilities, I went to Germany once to lead a retreat and stayed with a married couple there who were in the congregation. They're now lay ministers. And the gentleman was his job was, he was an importer-exporter, and he had this picture. And there I was in this living room. Wow, I've never seen anything like this. And I said, God, if you could get us a copy of that sometime, that would be great. And I gather years later it turned up at Throssell Priory Abbey, and then we got a copy from them. But it's probably quite unusual. I haven't seen many of them. So, the conversion of a hungry ghost. Well, we've done the ceremony. We've made the offerings. The food will all get eaten. I think traditionally in Japan, anyway, the sacristans eat the food at midnight. They leave it on the altar until then. But I think our sacristans would have a very hard time. They probably have a fleet of sacristans, a whole big crew of them. And also we have to clean it up before midnight. So we take it to the community and offer the food and thereby help heal our own hungry ghost karma, should we have any. And we all know what that feels like, that indulgence in greed, that intense craving to find satisfaction in things other than where they can be found. Well, tonight is another ceremony which we invite you all to. It's called the burning of the paper tombstones, or called Sagaki Toro, and it's a continuation of the Sagaki continuation of this ceremony, in that we have an opportunity to burn up any residual karma that may be lingering, both our own and also that of others whom we've remembered today. Especially if you feel like someone really needs extra help, we have these paper tombstones. I think we have them outside, do we, and at the guest house? So you can, you're welcome to take one and write the name of a deceased person who you may have remembered at this ceremony and who you'd like to give additional help to. And it's all confidential. It's put in another envelope, and it will be placed on a fire tonight. And you can include, as I mentioned to the retreat guests on the first day, any bits of karma or clinging, or it occurred to me even this morning as I was thinking about it, views and opinions that are hard to let go of could be included too. Things that are that need some help on their way can be placed in the fire. And we were thinking also, given all that's happened in our monastery in the last couple of years with the departure, sadly, of our former abbot, and the many difficulties and the grief and suffering surrounding that, which, of course, we are healing from. And yet, if any of you have anything connected to that that would be helpful to put in the fire, we would like to invite you to do so as well. You can identify it and name it, if you like, and put it on one of the paper tombstones. And they are put in that envelope. They're confidential. You don't have to put your name on it. And the sacristan will then take it with other offerings. And our abbess will place them all on the fire this evening as we chant the scripture of great wisdom, the Heart Sutra, that points to the emptiness, the non-self of all things. And thus we burn up all this karma and all this clinging in the great fire of training, of emptiness. So that's happening tonight. And please take advantage of that if you'd like to. Well, I'll end our talk today with maybe I'll read to you this offertory that we sung today. I find these offertories go by so quickly, not just when I'm singing them, but also when I'm listening to them. And many of them are just so profound. And so perhaps I'll just read it to you. I might explain a thing or two to finish the talk. The body of the Buddha permeates the universe. It manifests itself in front of all of us. There is no place where it does not so manifest itself. So, as I was saying, we have the six worlds, the various states of existence, and in each of those worlds, when they're depicted as a wheel of life, there's also a Buddha in each of the worlds, in a little disc usually. Of course, the beings have to look up to that Buddha to find the teaching that will help them in that particular state. But the Buddha is there, and they're never abandoned. And so the offertory emphasizes that. There's no place where the Tathagata does not manifest. It does so for every relationship and in all need. Yet it is still in its own true place. The seas of its merit cannot be counted. We pray that the three treasures of Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha may give us their loving kindness. We have decorated these altars and offered many things that exist within the sea, the fields, and the mountains, and opened the gate of the Dharma that is the most excellent in all the world. We have made much ceremonial and recited various scriptures and invocations, and we pray that the merit thereof may be turned to the good of all animate things in the endless world, and to the spirits that are lacking in wealth in the nether worlds, and to the evil and wicked in heaven. We've talked a bit about the hungry ghosts, the spirits lacking in wealth, believing they have nothing, they lack everything in the nether worlds. We were reflecting yesterday, but what are the evil and wicked in heaven? Be interesting to hear your interpretations on that, but it came to me that perhaps that happens when we have everything we want and need and yet are still dissatisfied and, you know, take things for granted. How often do we suffer from that, especially perhaps in some of our Western cultures where we have a higher standard of living and yet we're not satisfied, and we can very much take things for granted and thus find eventually that our time in heaven is very limited as well. We pray that everything may realize the truth and be released from all bad karma. Make the hidden and apparent free, and complete the right and true wisdom. Thank you.